Then, as much as she can, anyway. Half her body is encased in plaster, and one of her hands is cuffed to the bed, as if she could escape even if she wanted to. Her hair is messy, knotted, but of course, she's still pretty. "What are you doing here?" she says. I don't answer. I check the corners of the room for cameras, and there's one across from me, pointed at Nita's hospital bed. "There aren't microphones," she says. "They don't really do that here." "Good." I pull up a chair and sit beside her. "I'm here because I need important information from you." I already told them everything I felt like telling them. She glares at me. "I've got nothing more to say, especially not to the person who shot me." "If I hadn't shot you, I wouldn't be David's favorite person, and I wouldn't know all the things I know." I glance at the door, more from paranoia than an actual concern that someone is listening in. "We've got a new plan, Matthew and I, and Tobias, and it will require getting into the weapons lab." "And you thought I could help you with that?" She shakes her head. "I couldn't get in the first time, remember?" "I need to know what the security is like. Is David the only person who knows the passcode?" "Not, like, the only person ever," she says. "That would be stupid. His superiors know it, but he's the only person in the compound, yes." "Okay, then what's the backup security measure? The one that is activated if you explode the doors?" She presses her lips together so they almost disappear and stares at the half-body cast covering her. "It's the death serum," she says, "in aerosol form. It's practically unstoppable. Even if you wear a clean suit or something, it works its way in eventually. It just takes a little more time that way. That's what the lab report said. So they just automatically kill anyone who makes their way into that room without the passcode?" I say. "It surprises you?" "I guess not." I balance my elbows on my knees. "And there's no other way in except with David's code. Which, as you found out, he is completely unwilling to share," she says. "There's no chance a GP could resist the death serum?" I say. "No, definitely not." "Most GPs can't resist the truth serum either," I say. "But I can." "If you want to go flirt with death, be my guest." She leans back into the pillows. I'm done with that now. "One more question," I say. "Say I do want to flirt with death. Where do I get explosives to break through the doors? Like I'm going to tell you that?" "I don't think you get it," I say. "If this plan succeeds, you won't be imprisoned for life anymore. You'll recover and you'll go free. So it's in your best interest to help me." She stares at me like she is weighing and measuring me. Her wrist tugs against the handcuff, just enough that the metal carves a line into her skin. "Reggie has the explosives," she says. "He can teach you how to use them, but he's no good in action. So for God's sake, don't bring him along unless you feel like babysitting." "Noted," I say. "Tell him it will require twice as much firepower to get through those doors than any others. They're extremely sturdy." I nod. My watch beeps on the hour, signaling that my time is up. I stand and push my chair back to the corner where I found it. "Thank you for the help," I say. "What is the plan?" she says. "If you don't mind telling me." I pause, hesitating over the words. "Well," I say eventually, "let's just say it will erase the phrase genetically damaged from everyone's vocabulary." The guard opens the door, probably to yell at me for overstaying my welcome, but I'm already making my way out. I look over my shoulder just once before going, and I see that Nita is wearing a small smile.
Chapter 40. Tobias. Amar agrees to help us get into the city without requiring much persuasion, eager for an adventure as I knew he would be. We agree to meet that evening for dinner to talk through the plan with Christina, Peter, and George, who will help us get a vehicle. After I talk to Amar, I walk to the dormitory and lay with a pillow over my head for a long time, cycling through a script of what I will say to Zeke when I see him. "I'm sorry," I was doing what I thought I had to do, and everyone else was looking after Uriah, and I didn't think. People come into the room and leave it. The heat switches on and pushes through the vents and then turns off again. And all the while I am thinking through that script, concocting excuses and then discarding them, choosing the right tone, the right gestures. Finally, I grow frustrated and take the pillow from my face and fling it against the opposite wall. Kara, who is just smoothing a clean shirt down over her hips, jumps back. "I thought you were asleep," she says. "Sorry." She touches her hair, ensuring that each strand is secure. She is so careful in her movements, so precise. It reminds me of the Amity musicians plucking at banjo strings. "I have a question," I sit up. "It's kind of personal." "Okay?" She sits across from me on Triss's bed. "Ask it." "How were you able to forgive Triss after what she did to your brother?" I say. "Assuming you have, that is." Kara hugs her arms close to her body. "Sometimes I think I have forgiven her. Sometimes I'm not certain I have. I don't know how. It's like asking how you continue on with your life after someone dies. You just do it. And the next day, you do it again." "Is there any way she could have made it easier for you, or any way she did?" "Why are you asking this?" She sets her hand on my knee. "Is it because of Uriah?" "Yes," I say firmly, and shift my leg a little so her hand falls away. I don't need to be patted or consoled like a child. I don't need her raised eyebrows or soft voice to coax an emotion from me that I would prefer to contain. "Okay," she straightens, and when she speaks again she sounds casual the way she usually does. "I think the most crucial thing she did, admittedly without meaning to, was confess. There is a difference between admitting and confessing. Admitting involves softening, making excuses for things that cannot be excused. Confessing just names the crime at its full severity. That was something I needed." A nod. "And after you've confessed to Zeke," she says, "I think it would help if you leave him alone for as long as he wants to be left alone. That's all you can do." I nod again. "But four," she adds, "you didn't kill Uriah. You didn't set off the bomb that injured him. You didn't make the plan that led to the explosion." "But I did participate in the plan." "Oh, shut up, would you?" She says it gently, smiling at me. "It happened. It was awful. You aren't perfect, that's all there is. Don't confuse your grief with guilt." We stay in the silence and the loneliness of the otherwise empty dormitory for a few more minutes, and I try to let her words work themselves into me. I eat dinner with Amar, George, Christina, and Peter in the cafeteria between the beverage counter and a row of trash cans. The bowl of soup before me went cold before I could eat all of it, and there are still crackers swimming in the broth. Amar tells us where and when to meet. Then we go to the hallway near the kitchens so we won't be seen, and he takes out a small black box with syringes inside it. He gives one to Christina, Peter, and me, along with an individually packaged antibacterial wipe, something I suspect only Amar will bother with. "What's this?" Christina says. "I'm not going to inject it into my body unless I know what it is." "Fine," Amar folds his hands. "There's a chance that we will still be in the city when a memory serum virus is deployed. You'll need to inoculate yourselves against it unless you want to forget everything you now remember. It's the same thing you'll be injecting into your family's arms, so don't worry about it." Christina turns her arm over and slaps the inside of her elbow until a vein stands at attention. Out of habit, I stick the needle into the side of my neck, the same way I did every time I went through my fear landscape, which was several times a week at one point. Amar does the same thing. I notice, however, that Peter only pretends to inject himself. When he presses the plunger down, the fluid runs down his throat, and he wipes it casually with a sleeve. I wonder what it feels like to volunteer to forget everything. After dinner, Christina walks up to me and says, "We need to talk." We walk down the long flight of stairs that leads to the underground GD space, our knees bouncing in unison with each step and down the multicolored hallway. At the end, Christina crosses her arms, purple light playing over her nose and mouth.
Amar doesn't know we're going to try to stop the reset? She says.
No, I say. He's loyal to the Bureau. I don't want to involve him.
You know, the city is still on the verge of revolution, she says, and the light turns blue. The Bureau's whole reason for resetting our friends and families is to stop them from killing each other. If we stop the reset, the Allegiant will attack Evelyn. Evelyn will turn the death serum loose, and a lot of people will die. I may still be mad at you, but I don't think you want that many people in the city to die. Your parents in particular.
I sigh. Honestly, I don't really care about them.
You can't be serious, she says, scowling. They're your parents.
I can be, actually, I say. I want to tell Zeke and his mother what I did to Uriah. Apart from that, I really don't care what happens to Evelyn and Marcus.
You may not care about your permanently messed up family, but you should care about everyone else, she says.
She takes my arm in one strong hand and jerks me so that I look at her.
Four, my little sister is in there. If Evelyn and the Allegiant smack into each other, she could get hurt, and I won't be there to protect her.
I saw Christina with her family on visiting day, when she was still just a loud-mouthed candor transfer to me. I watched her mother fix the collar of Christina's shirt with a proud smile. If the memory serum virus is deployed, that memory will be erased from her mother's mind. If it's not, her family will be caught in the middle of another city-wide battle for control. I say, "So what are you suggesting we do?" She releases me.
There has to be a way to prevent a huge blow-up that doesn't involve forcibly erasing everyone's memories.
Maybe, I concede. I hadn't thought about it because it didn't seem necessary. But it is necessary. Of course it's necessary. Did you have any idea how to stop it?
It's basically one of your parents against the other one, Christina says. Isn't there something you can say to them that will stop them from trying to kill each other?
Something I can say to them? I say.
Are you kidding? They don't listen to anyone. They don't do anything that doesn't directly benefit them. So there's nothing you can do. You're just going to let the city rip itself to shreds.
I stare at my shoes, bathed in green light, mulling it over. If I had different parents, if I had reasonable parents, less driven by pain and anger and the desire for revenge, it might work. They might be compelled to listen to their son. Unfortunately, I do not have different parents. But I could. I could if I wanted them. Just a slip of the memory serum in their morning coffee, or their evening water, and they would be new people. Clean slates, unblemished by history. They would have to be taught that they even had a son to begin with. They would need to learn my name again. It's the same technique we're using to heal the compound. I could use it to heal them. I look up at Christina. Get me some memory serum, I say. While you, Amar, and Peter are looking for your family and Uriah's family, I'll take care of it. I probably won't have enough time to get to both of my parents, but one of them will do.
How will you get away from the rest of us?
I don't know. We need to add a complication. Something that requires one of us leaving the pack.
What about a flat tire? Christina says. We're going at night, right? So I can tell Amar to stop so I can go to the bathroom or something, slash the tires, and then we'll have to split up so you can find another truck.
I consider this for a moment. I could tell Amar what's really going on, but that would require undoing the dense knot of propaganda and lies the Bureau has tied in his mind. Assuming I could even do it. We don't have the time for that. But we do have time for a well-told lie. Amar knows that my father taught me how to start a car with just the wires when I was younger. He wouldn't question me volunteering to find us another vehicle. That will work, I say.
Good.
She tilts her head.
So you're really going to erase one of your parents' memories?
What do you do when your parents are evil? I say. Get a new parent. If one of them doesn't have all the baggage they currently have, maybe the two of them can negotiate a peace agreement or something. She frowns at me for a few seconds like she wants to say something, but eventually, she just nods.
Chapter 41. Triss. The smell of bleach tingles in my nose. I stand next to a mop in a storage room in the basement. I stand in the wake of what I just told everyone, which is that whoever breaks into the weapons lab will be going on a suicide mission. The death serum is unstoppable. The question is, Matthew says, is this something we're willing to sacrifice a life for? This is the room where Matthew, Caleb, and Kara were developing the new serum, before the plan changed. Vials and beakers and scribbled-on notebooks are scattered across the lab table in front of Matthew. The string he wears tied around his neck is in his mouth now, and he chews it absent-mindedly. Tobias leans against the door, his arms crossed. I remember him standing that way during initiation, as he watched us fight each other. So tall and so strong, I never dreamed he would give me more than a cursory glance. It's not just about revenge, I say. It's not about what they did to the abnegation. It's about stopping them before they do something equally bad to the people in all the experiments, about taking away their power to control thousands of lives. It is worth it, Kara says. One death to save thousands of people from a terrible fate and cut the compound's power off at the knees, so to speak. Is it even a question? I know what she is doing, weighing a single life against so many lifetimes and memories, drawing an obvious conclusion from the scales. That is the way an erudite mind works, and the way an abnegation mind works, but I am not sure if they are the minds we need right now. One life against thousands of memories. Of course the answer is easy. But does it have to be one of our lives? Do we have to be the ones who act? But because I know what my answer will be to that question, my thoughts turn to another question. If it has to be one of us, who should it be? My eyes shift from Matthew and Kara, standing behind the table, to Tobias, to Christina, her arms slung over a broom handle, and land on Caleb. Him. A second later, I feel sick with myself. Oh, just come out with it, Caleb says, lifting his eyes to mine. You want me to do it. You all do. No one said that, Matthew says, spitting out the string necklace. Everyone's staring at me, Caleb says. Don't think I don't know it. I'm the one who chose the wrong side, who worked with Janine Matthews. I'm the one none of you care about, so I should be the one to die. Why do you think Tobias offered to get you out of the city before they executed you? My voice comes out cold, quiet. The odor of bleach plays over my nose. Because I don't care whether you live or die? Because I don't care about you at all? He should be the one to die, part of me thinks. I don't want to lose him, another part argues. I don't know which part to trust, which part to believe. You think I don't know hatred when I see it? Caleb shakes his head. I see it every time you look at me, on the rare occasions when you do look at me. His eyes are glossy with tears. It's the first time since my near execution that I've seen him remorseful instead of defensive or full of excuses. It might also be the first time since then that I've seen him as my brother, instead of the coward who sold me out to Janine Matthews. Suddenly, I have trouble swallowing. If I do this, he says. I shake my head no, but he holds up a hand. Stop, he says. Beatrice, if I do this, will you be able to forgive me? To me, when someone wrongs you, you both share the burden of that wrongdoing. The pain of it weighs on both of you. Forgiveness, then, means choosing to bear the full weight all by yourself. Caleb's betrayal is something we both carry, and since he did it, all I've wanted is for him to take its weight away from me. I am not sure that I'm capable of shouldering it all myself. Not sure that I'm strong enough or good enough. But I see him steeling himself against this fate, and I know that I have to be strong enough and good enough if he is going to sacrifice himself for us all. I nod. Yes, I choke out. but that's not a good reason to do this. I have plenty of reasons, Caleb says. I'll do it. Of course I will. I am not sure what just happened. Matthew and Caleb stay behind to fit Caleb for the clean suit, the suit that will keep him alive in the weapons lab long enough to set off the memory serum virus. I wait until the others leave before leaving myself. I want to walk back to the dormitory with only my thoughts as company. A few weeks ago, I would have volunteered to go on the suicide mission myself, and I did. I volunteered to go to Erudite headquarters, knowing that death waited for me there. But it wasn't because I was selfless, or because I was brave. It was because I was guilty, and a part of me wanted to lose everything. A grieving, ailing part of me wanted to die. Is that what's motivating Caleb now? Should I really allow him to die so that he feels like his debt to me is repaid? I walk the hallway with its rainbow of lights and go up the stairs. I can't even think of an alternative. Would I be any more willing to lose Christina or Kara or Matthew? No. The truth is that I would be less willing to lose them, because they have been good friends to me, and Caleb has not. Not for a long time. Even before he betrayed me, he left me for the erudite and didn't look back. I was the one who went to visit him during my initiation, and he spent the whole time wondering why I was there. And I don't want to die anymore. I am up to the challenge of bearing the guilt and the grief, up to facing the difficulties that life has put in my path. Some days are harder than others, but I am ready to live each one of them. I can't sacrifice myself this time. In the most honest parts of me, I am able to admit that it was a relief to hear Caleb volunteer. Suddenly, I can't think about it anymore. I reach the hotel entrance and walk to the dormitory, hoping that I can just collapse into my bed and sleep. But Tobias is waiting in the hallway for me. You okay? He says. Yes, I say, but I shouldn't be. I touch a hand, briefly, to my forehead. I feel like I've already been mourning him, like he died the second I saw him in Erudite headquarters while I was there. You know? I confessed to Tobias, soon after that, that I had lost my entire family, and he assured me that he was my family now. That is how it feels. Like everything between us is twisted together. Friendship and love and family. So I can't tell the difference between any of them. The abnegation of teachings about this, you know, he says. About when to let others sacrifice themselves for you. Even if it's selfish. They say that if the sacrifice is the ultimate way for that person to show you that they love you, you should let them do it. He leans one shoulder into the wall. That, in that situation, it's the greatest gift you can give them. Just as it was when both of your parents died for you. I'm not sure it's love that's motivating him, though. I close my eyes. It seems more like guilt. Maybe, Tobias admits. But why would he feel guilty for betraying you if he didn't love you? I nod. I know that Caleb loves me. And always has, even when he was hurting me. I know that I love him too. But this feels wrong anyway. Still, I am able to be momentarily placated, knowing that this is something my parents might have understood if they were here right now. This may be a bad time, he says. But there's something I want to say to you. I tense immediately, afraid that he's going to name some crime of mine that went unacknowledged, or a confession that's eating away at him, or something equally difficult. His expression is unreadable. I just want to thank you, he says, his voice low. A group of scientists told you that my genes were damaged, that there was something wrong with me. They showed you test results that proved it, and even I started to believe it. He touches my face, his thumb skimming my cheekbone, and his eyes are on mine. Intense and insistent. You never believed it, he says. Not for a second. You always insisted that I was, I don't know, whole. I cover his hand with my own. Well, you are, No one has ever told me that before, he says softly. It's what you deserve to hear, I say firmly, my eyes going cloudy with tears. That you're whole, that you're worth loving, that you're the best person I've ever known. Just as the last word leaves my mouth, he kisses me. I kiss him back, so hard it hurts, and twist my fingers into his shirt. I push him down the hallway and through one of the doors to a sparsely furnished room near the dormitory. I kick the door shut with my heel. Just as I have insisted on his worth, he has always insisted on my strength, insisted that my capacity is greater than I believe. And I know, without being told, that's what love does. When it's right, it makes you more than you were, more than you thought you could be. This is right. His fingers slide over my hair and curl into it. My hands shake, but I don't care if he notices. I don't care if he knows that I'm afraid of how intense this feels. I draw his shirt into my fists, tugging him closer, and sigh his name against his mouth. I forget that he is another person. Instead, it feels like he is another part of me, just as essential as a heart, or an eye, or an arm. I pull his shirt up and over his head. I run my hands over the skin I expose like it is my own. His hands clutch at my shirt, and I am removing it, and then I remember. I remember that I am small and flat-chested and sickly pale, and I pull back. He looks at me, not like he's waiting for an explanation, but like I am the only thing in the room worth looking at. I look at him, too, but everything I see makes me feel worse. He is so handsome, and even the black ink curling over his skin makes him into a piece of art. A moment ago, I was convinced that we were perfectly matched, and maybe we still are, but only with our clothes on. But he is still looking at me that way. He smiles, a small, shy smile. Then he puts his hand on my waist and draws me toward him. He bends down and kisses between his fingers and whispers, "Beautiful," against my stomach, and I believe him. He stands and presses his lips to mine, his mouth open, his hands on my bare hips, his thumbs slipping under the top of my jeans. I touch my chest, lean into him, feel his sigh singing in my bones. "I love you, you know," I say. "I know," he replies. With a quirk of his eyebrows, he bends and wraps an arm around my legs, throwing me over his shoulder. A laugh bursts from my mouth, half joy and half nerves, and he carries me across the room, dropping me unceremoniously on the couch. He lies down next to me, and I run my fingers over the flames wrapping around his rib cage. He is strong and lithe and certain, and he is mine. I fit my mouth to his. I was so afraid that we would just keep colliding over and over again if we stayed together, and that eventually the impact would break me. But now I know. I am like the blade, and he is like the whetstone. I am too strong to break so easily, and I become better, sharper, every time I touch him.
Chapter 42. Tobias. The first thing I see when I wake, still on the couch in the hotel room, are the birds flying over her collarbone. Her shirt, retrieved from the floor in the middle of the night because of the cold, is pulled down on one side from where she's lying on it. We have slept close to each other before, but this time feels different. Every other time we were there to comfort each other or to protect each other. This time we're here just because we want to be, and because we fell asleep before we could go back to the dormitory. I stretch out my hand and touch my fingertips to her tattoos, and she opens her eyes. She wraps an arm around me and pulls herself across the cushion so she's right up against me, warm and soft and pliable. "Morning," I say. "Shh," she says. "If you don't acknowledge it, maybe it will go away." I draw her toward me, my hand on her hip. Her eyes are wide, alert, despite just having opened. I kiss her cheek, then her jaw, then her throat, lingering there for a few seconds. Her hands tighten around my waist and she sighs into my ear. My self-control is about to disappear in 5, 4, 3. "Tobias," she whispers. "I hate to say this, but I think we have just a few things to do today." "They can wait," I say against her shoulder, and I kiss the first tattoo, slowly. "No, they can't," she says. I flop back onto the cushions, and I feel cold without her body parallel to mine. "Yeah, about that. I was thinking your brother could use some target practice just in case."
"That might be a good idea," she says quietly. "He's only fired a gun, what, once? Twice?"
"I can teach him," I say. "If there's one thing I'm good at, it's aiming. And it might make him feel better to do something."
"Thank you,"
she says. She sits up and puts her fingers through her hair to comb it. In the morning light, its color looks brighter, like it's threaded with gold.
"I know you don't like him, but..."
"But if you're going to let what he did go," I say, taking her hand, "then I'm going to try to do the same." She smiles and kisses my cheek. I skim the lingering shower water from the back of my neck with my palm. Triss, Caleb, Christina, and I are in the training room in the GD area underground. It's cold and dim and full of equipment. Training weapons and mats and helmets and targets. Everything we could ever need. I select the right practice gun. The one about the size of a pistol but bulkier, and offer it to Caleb. Triss's fingers slide between mine. Everything comes easily this morning. Every smile and every laugh. Every word and every motion. If we succeed in what we attempt tonight, tomorrow Chicago will be safe. The Bureau will be forever changed, and Triss and I will be able to build a new life for ourselves somewhere. Maybe it will even be a place where I trade my guns and knives for more productive tools, screwdrivers and nails and shovels. This morning I feel like I could be so fortunate. I could. "It doesn't shoot real bullets," I say. "But it seems like they designed it so it would be as close as possible to one of the guns you'll be using. It feels real, anyway." Caleb holds the gun with just his fingertips, like he's afraid it will shatter in his hands. I laugh. "First lesson. Don't be afraid of it. Grab it. You've held one before, remember? You got us out of the Amity compound with that shot."
"That was just lucky,"
Caleb says, turning the gun over and over to see it from every angle. His tongue pushes into his cheek like he's solving a problem.
"Not the result of skill."
"Lucky is better than unlucky," I say. "We can work on skill now." I glance at Triss. She grins at me, then leans in to whisper something to Christina.
"Are you here to help or what, stiff?"
I say. I hear myself speaking in the voice I cultivated as an initiation instructor. But this time I use it in jest.
"You could use some practice with that right arm, if I recall correctly. You too, Christina."
Triss makes a face at me. Then she and Christina cross the room to get their own weapons. "Okay. Now face the target and turn the safety off," I say. There is a target across the room, more sophisticated than the wooden board target in the Dauntless training rooms. It has 3 rings in 3 different colors, green, yellow, and red, so it's easier to tell where the bullets hit. "Let me see how you would naturally shoot." He lifts up the gun with one hand, squares off his feet and shoulders to the target like he's about to lift something heavy, and fires. The gun jerks back and up, firing the bullet near the ceiling. I cover my mouth with my hand to disguise my smile.
"There's no need to giggle," Caleb says irritably.
"Book learning doesn't teach you everything, does it?" Christina says.
"You have to hold it with both hands. It doesn't look as cool, but neither does attacking the ceiling." "I wasn't trying to look cool."
Christina stands, her legs slightly uneven, and lifts both arms. She stares at the target for a moment, then fires. The training bullet hits the outer circle of the target and bounces off, rolling on the floor. It leaves a circle of light on the target, marking the impact site. I wish I'd had this technology during initiation training.
Oh, good, I say. You hit the air around your target's body. How useful.
I'm a little rusty, Christina admits, grinning.
I think the easiest way for you to learn would be to mimic me, I say to Caleb. I stand the way I always stand, easy, natural, and lift both my arms, squeezing the gun with one hand and steadying it with the other. Caleb tries to match me, beginning with his feet and moving up with the rest of him. As eager as Christina was to tease him, it's his ability to analyze that makes him successful. I can see him changing angles and distances and tension and release as he looks me over trying to get everything right.
Good, I say when he's finished. Now focus on what you're trying to hit and nothing else. I stare at the center of the target and try to let it swallow me. The distance doesn't trouble me. The bullet will travel straight, just like it would if I was closer. I inhale and brace myself, exhale and fire. And the bullet goes right where I meant to put it, in the red circle in the center of the target. I step back to watch Caleb try it. He has the right way of standing, the right way of holding the gun, but he is rigid there, a statue with a gun in his hand. He sucks in a breath and holds it as he fires. This time the kickback doesn't startle him as much, and the bullet nicks the top of the target.
Good, I say again. I think what you mostly need is to get comfortable with it. You're very tense.
Can you blame me?
He says. His voice trembles, but just at the end of each word. He has the look of someone who is trapping terror inside. I watched two classes of initiates with that expression, but none of them was ever facing what Caleb is facing now. I shake my head and say quietly, "Of course not." But you have to realize that if you can't let that tension go tonight, you might not make it to the weapons lab, and what good would that do anyone? He sighs. The physical technique is important, I say, but it's mostly a mental game, which is lucky for you because you know how to play those. You don't just practice the shooting, you also practice the focus. And then, when you're in a situation where you're fighting for your life, the focus will be so ingrained that it will happen naturally.
I didn't know the Dauntless were so interested in training the brain, Caleb says. Can I see you try it, Triss? I don't think I've ever really seen you shoot something without a bullet wound in your shoulder.
Triss smiles a little and faces the target. When I first saw her shoot during Dauntless training, she looked awkward, bird-like. But her thin, fragile form has become slim but muscular, and when she holds the gun, it looks easy. She squints one eye a little, shifts her weight, and fires. Her bullet strays from the target's center, but only by inches. Obviously impressed, Caleb raises his eyebrows.
Don't look so surprised, Triss says.
Sorry, he says. You used to be so clumsy, remember? I don't know how I missed that you weren't like that anymore. Triss shrugs. But when she looks away, her cheeks are flushed and she looks pleased. Christina shoots again, and this time hits the target closer to the middle. I step back to let Caleb practice, and watch Triss fire again. Watch the straight lines of her body as she lifts the gun, and how steady she is when it goes off. I touch her shoulder and lean in close to her ear.
Remember during training how the gun almost hit you in the face?
She nods, smirking.
Remember during training when I did this?
I say, and I reach around her to press my hand to her stomach. She sucks in a breath.
I'm not likely to forget that any time soon, she mutters.
She twists around and draws my face toward hers, her fingertips on my chin. We kiss, and I hear Christina say something about it, but for the first time, I don't care at all. There isn't much to do after target practice, but wait. Triss and Christina get the explosives from Reggie and teach Caleb how to use them. Then Matthew and Kara pore over a map, examining different routes to get through the compound to the weapons lab. Christina and I meet with Amar, George, and Peter to go over the route we're going to take through the city that evening. Triss is called to a last-minute council meeting. Matthew inoculates people against the memory serum all throughout the day. Kara and Caleb and Triss and Nita and Reggie and himself. There isn't enough time to think about the significance of what we're going to try to do. Stop a revolution. Save the experiments. Change the Bureau forever. While Triss is gone, I go to the hospital to see Uriah one last time before I bring his family back to him. When I get there, I can't go in. From here, through the glass, I can pretend that he is just asleep, and that if I touched him, he would wake up and smile and make a joke. In there, I would be able to see how lifeless he is now, how the shock to his brain took the last parts of him that were Uriah. I squeeze my hands into fists to disguise their shaking. Matthew approaches from the end of the hallway, his hands in the pockets of his dark blue uniform. His gait is relaxed, his footsteps heavy. "Hey." "Hi," I say. "I was just inoculating Nita," he says. "She's in better spirits today." "Good." Matthew taps the glass with his knuckles. "So, you going to go get his family later?" "That's what Triss told me." I nod. "His brother and his mom." I've met Zeke and Uriah's mother before. She is a small woman with power in her bearing, and one of the rare dauntless who goes about things quietly and without ceremony. I liked her and I was afraid of her at the same time. "No dad?" Matthew says. "Died when they were young. Not surprising among the dauntless." "Right." We stand in silence for a little while, and I'm grateful for his presence, which keeps me from being overwhelmed by grief. I know that Kara was right yesterday to tell me that I didn't kill Uriah, not really, but it still feels like I did. And maybe it always will. "I've been meaning to ask you," I say after a while. "Why are you helping us with this? It seems like a big risk for someone who isn't personally invested in the outcome." "I am, though," Matthew says. "It's sort of a long story." He crosses his arms, then tugs at the string around his throat with his thumb. "There was this girl," he says. "She was genetically damaged. And that meant I wasn't supposed to go out with her, right? We're supposed to make sure that we match ourselves with optimal partners so we produce genetically superior offspring or something. Well, I was feeling rebellious, and there was something appealing about how forbidden it was, so she and I started dating. I never meant for it to become anything serious, but..." "But it did," I supply. He nods. "It did. She, more than anything else, convinced me that the compound's position on genetic damage was twisted. She was a better person than I was, than I'll ever be. And then she got attacked. A bunch of GPs beat her up. She had kind of a smart mouth. She was never content to just stay where she was. I think that had something to do with it. Or maybe nothing did. Maybe people just do things like that out of nowhere, and trying to find a reason just frustrates the mind." I look closely at the string he's toying with. I always thought it was black, but when I look closely, I see that it's actually green, the color of the support staff uniforms. "Anyway, she was injured pretty badly, but one of the GPs was a council member's kid. He claimed the attack was provoked, and that was the excuse they used when they let him and the other GPs off with some community service. But I knew better." He starts nodding along with his own words. "I knew that they let them off because they thought of her as something less than them. Like if the GPs had beat up an animal." A shiver starts at the top of my spine and travels down my back. "What? What happened to her?" Matthew glances at me. "She died a year later during a surgical procedure to fix some of the damage. It was a fluke, an infection." He drops his hands. "The day she died was the day I started helping Nita. I didn't think her recent plan was a good one, though, which is why I didn't help out with it. But then, I also didn't try that hard to stop her." I cycle through the things you're supposed to say at times like these. The apologies and the sympathy. And I don't find a single phrase that feels right to me. Instead, I just let the silence stretch out between us. It's the only adequate response to what he just told me. The only thing that does the tragedy justice instead of patching it up hastily and moving on. "I know it doesn't seem like it," Matthew says. But I hate them. The muscles in his jaw stand at attention. He has never struck me as a warm person, but he's never been cold either. That is what he's like now. A man encased in ice. His eyes hard and his voice like a frosty exhale. And I would have volunteered to die instead of Caleb, if not for the fact that I really want to see them suffer the repercussions. I want to watch them fumble around under the memory serum, not knowing who they are anymore, because that's what happened to me when she died. That sounds like adequate punishment, I say. More adequate than killing them would be, Matthew says. And besides, I'm not a murderer. I feel uneasy. It's not often you encounter the real person behind a good-natured mask, the darkest parts of someone. It's not comfortable when you do. I'm sorry for what happened to Uriah, Matthew says. I'll leave you with him. He puts his hands back in his pockets and continues down the hallway, his lips puckered in a whistle.
Chapter 43. Triss. The emergency council meeting is more of the same. Confirmation that the viruses will be dropped over the cities this evening. Discussions about what planes will be used and at what times. David and I exchange friendly words when the meeting is over. And then I slip out while the others are still sipping coffee and walk back to the hotel. Tobias takes me to the atrium near the hotel dormitory, and we spend some time there, talking and kissing, and pointing out the strangest plants. It feels like something that normal people do. Go on dates, talk about small things, laugh. We have had so few of those moments. Most of our time together has been spent running from one threat or another, or running toward one threat or another. But I can see a time on the horizon when that won't need to happen anymore. We will reset the people in the compound and work to rebuild this place together. Maybe then we can find out if we do as well with the quiet moments as we have with the loud ones. I am looking forward to it. Finally, the time comes for Tobias to leave. I stand on the higher step in the atrium, and he stands on the lower one, so we're on the same plane. I don't like that I can't be with you tonight, he says. It doesn't feel right to leave you alone with something this huge. What? You don't think I can handle it? I say, a little defensive. Obviously, that is not what I think. He touches his hands to my face and leans his forehead against mine. I just don't want you to have to bear it alone. I don't want you to have to bear Uriah's family alone, I say softly. But I think these are things we have to do separately. I'm glad I'll get to be with Caleb before, you know. It'll be nice not having to worry about you at the same time. Yeah. He closes his eyes. I can't wait until tomorrow, when I'm back and you've done what you set out to do, and we can decide what comes next. I can tell you it will involve a lot of this, I say, and I press my lips to his. His hands shift from my cheeks to my shoulders, and then slide painstakingly down my back. His fingers find the hem of my shirt, then slip under it, warm and insistent. I feel aware of everything at once, of the pressure of his mouth, and the taste of our kiss, and the texture of his skin, and the orange light glowing against my closed eyelids, and the smell of green things, growing things in the air. When I pull away, and he opens his eyes, I see everything about them. The dart of light blue in his left eye. The dark blue that makes me feel like I am safe inside it, like I am dreaming. I love you, I say. I love you too, he says. I'll see you soon. He kisses me again, softly, and then leaves the atrium. I stand in that shaft of sunlight until the sun disappears. It's time to be with my brother now.
Chapter 44. Tobias. I check the screens before I go to meet Amar and George. Evelyn is holed up in Erudite headquarters with her factionless supporters, leaning over a map of the city. Marcus and Johanna are in a building on Michigan Avenue, north of the Hancock Building, conducting a meeting. I hope that's where they both are in a few hours when I decide which of my parents to reset. Amar gave us a little over an hour to find and inoculate Uriah's family and get back to the compound unnoticed, so I only have time for one of them. Snow swirls over the pavement outside, floating on the wind. George offers me a gun. It's dangerous in there right now, he says, with all that Allegiant stuff going on. I take the gun without even looking at it. You are all familiar with the plan? George says. I'm going to be monitoring you from here, from the small control room. We'll see how useful I am tonight, though, with all this snow obscuring the cameras. And where will the other security people be? Drinking? George shrugs. I told them to take the night off. No one will notice the truck is gone. It'll be fine, I promise. Amar grins. All right, let's pile in. George squeezes Amar's arm and waves at the rest of us. As the others follow Amar to the parked truck outside, I grab George and hold him back. He gives me a strange look. Don't ask me any questions about this because I won't answer them, I say. But inoculate yourself against the memory serum, okay? As soon as possible. Matthew can help you. He frowns at me. Just do it, I say, and go out to the truck. Snowflakes cling to my hair and vapor curls around my mouth with each breath. Christina bumps into me on our way to the truck and slips something into my pocket. A vial. I see Peter's eyes on us as I get in the passenger seat. I'm still not sure why he was so eager to come with us, but now I know I need to be wary of him. The inside of the truck is warm, and soon we are all covered with beads of water instead of snow. Lucky you, Amar says. He hands me a glass screen with bright lines tangled across it like veins. I look closer and see that they are streets, and the brightest line traces our path through them. You get to man the map. You need a map? I raise my eyebrows. Has it not occurred to you to just aim for the giant buildings? Amar makes a face at me. We aren't just driving straight into the city. We're taking a stealth route. Now shut up and man the map. I find a blue dot on the map that marks our position. Amar urges the truck into the snow, which falls so fast I can only see a few feet in front of us. The buildings we drive past look like dark figures peeking through a white shroud. Amar drives fast, trusting the weight of the truck to keep us steady. Between snowflakes, I see the city lights up ahead. I had forgotten how close we were to it, because everything is so different just outside its limits. I can't believe we're going back, Peter says quietly, like he doesn't expect a response. Me either, I say, because it's true. The distance the Bureau has kept from the rest of the world is an evil separate from the war they intend to wage against our memories. More subtle, but in its way just as sinister. They had the capacity to help us, languishing in our factions, but instead they let us fall apart. Let us die. Let us kill one another. Only now that we are about to destroy more than an acceptable level of genetic material are they deciding to intervene. We bounce back and forth in the truck as Amar drives over the railroad tracks, staying close to the high cement wall on our right. I look at Christina in the rearview mirror. Her right knee bounces fast. I still don't know whose memory I'm going to take. Marcus's or Evelyn's? Usually I would try to decide what the most selfless choice would be, but in this case, either choice feels selfish. Resetting Marcus would mean erasing the man I hate and fear from the world. It would mean my freedom from his influence. Resetting Evelyn would mean making her into a new mother, one who wouldn't abandon me, or make decisions out of a desire for revenge or control everyone in an effort not to have to trust them. Either way, with either parent gone, I am better off. But what would help the city most? I no longer know. I hold my hands over the air vents to warm them as Amar continues to drive over the railroad tracks and past the abandoned train car we saw on our way in, reflecting the headlights in its silver panels. We reach the place where the outside world ends and the experiment begins, as abrupt a shift as if someone had drawn a line in the ground. Amar drives over that line like it isn't there. For him, I suppose it has faded with time as he grows more and more used to his new world. For me, it feels like driving from truth into a lie, from adulthood into childhood. I watch the land of pavement and glass and metal turn into an empty field. The snow is falling softly now, and I can faintly see the city's skyline up ahead, the buildings just a shade darker than the clouds.
"Where should we go find Zeke?" Amar says.
"Zeke and his mother joined up with the revolt," I say, "so wherever most of them are is my best bet."
"Control room people said most of them have taken up residence north of the river near the Hancock building," Amar says. "Feel like going ziplining?"
"Absolutely not," I say. Amar laughs. It takes us another hour to get close. Only when I see the Hancock building in the distance do I start to feel nervous.
Amar? Christina says from the back. "I hate to say this, but I really need to stop and, you know, pee."
"Right now?" Amar says.
"Yeah, it came on all of a sudden."
He sighs, but pulls the truck over to the side of the road.
"You guys stay here and don't look," Christina says as she gets out.
I watch her silhouette move to the back of the truck and wait. All I feel when she slashes the tires is a slight bounce in the truck, so small I'm sure I only felt it because I was waiting for it. When Christina gets back in, brushing snowflakes from her jacket, she wears a small smile. Sometimes all it takes to save people from a terrible fate is one person willing to do something about it, even if that something is fake a bathroom break. Amar drives for a few more minutes before anything happens. Then the truck shudders and starts to bounce like we're going over bumps. "Shit," Amar says, scowling at the speedometer. "I can't believe this." "Flat?" I say.
"Yeah."
He sighs and eases on the brakes so the car slips to a stop by the side of the road. "I'll check it," I say. I jump down from the passenger seat and walk to the back of the truck. The back tires are completely flat, flayed by the knife Christina brought with her. I peer through the back window to make sure there's only one spare tire, then return to my open door to give the news. "Both back tires are flat and we only have one spare," I say. "We're going to have to abandon the truck and get a new one."
"Shit!"
Amar smacks the steering wheel.
"We don't have time for this. We have to make sure Zeke and his mother and Christina's family are all inoculated before the memory serum is released, or they'll be useless."
"Calm down," I say. "I know where we can find another vehicle. Why don't you guys keep going on foot and I'll go find something to drive?" Amar's expression brightens.
"Good idea."
Before moving away from the truck, I make sure that there are bullets in my gun, even though I'm not sure if I'll need them. Everyone piles out of the truck, Amar shivering in the cold and bouncing on his toes. I check my watch.
"So you need to inoculate them by what time?"
"George's schedule says we've got an hour before we reset the city," Amar says, checking his watch too to make sure.
"If you want to spare Zeke and his mother the grief and let them get reset, I wouldn't blame you. I'll do it if you need me to."
I shake my head. "Couldn't do that. They wouldn't be in pain, but it wouldn't be real."
"As I've always said," Amar says, smiling, "once a stiff, always a stiff."
"Can you not tell them what happened? Just until I get there," I say. "Just inoculate them? I want to be the one who tells them." Amar's smile shrinks a little.
"Sure.
Of course." My shoes are already soaked through from checking the tires, and my feet ache when they touch the cold ground again. I'm about to walk away from the truck when Peter speaks up.
"I'm coming with you," he says.
"What? Why?" I glare at him.
"You might need help finding a truck," he says. "It's a big city."
I look at Amar, who shrugs.
"Man's got a point."
Peter leans in closer and speaks quietly so only I can hear.
"And if you don't want me to tell him you're planning something, you won't object."
His eyes drift to my jacket pocket where the memory serum is. I sigh.
"Fine, but you do what I say."
I watch Amar and Christina walk away without us, heading toward the Hancock building. Once they're too far away to see us, I take a few steps back, slipping my hand into my pocket to protect the vial. I'm not going to look for a truck, I say. You might as well know that now. Are you going to help me with what I'm doing?